Just a reminder that round 8 of our 3-minute fiction contest is now open. It's where we ask you to write an original short story in under 600 words. Each round, we have a new challenge, and this time, our judge, the novelist Luis Alberto Urrea, wants each story to begin with this sentence.
She closed the book, put it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door.
So even with that sentence, the story must be under 600 words. The deadline to get your story in is 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 week from today, March 25th. And then we'll start posting standout stories at our website, npr.org/3-minute-fiction. The winning story will be read in its entirety, and the winner will appear on the program with Luis. For all the rules and to submit your story, visit npr.org/3-minute-fiction. That's 3-minute-fiction, all spelled out, no spaces, and good luck.
Some of the men playing in this year's NCAA tournament will go on to lucrative careers in the NBA. And with an average annual salary of more than $5 million, that will very likely make those men the primary breadwinners in their families. But in her new book, The Richer Sex, journalist Liza Mundy argues that traditional breadwinning roles are being flipped upside down, and now many women are carrying their families financially. We started off by asking Mundy to read a section of her book.
In a matter of decades, the traditional male breadwinner model has given way to one where women routinely support households and out-earn the men they are married to, and nobody cares or thinks it's odd. The Hawkins family, sane, functional, rooted in a Midwestern state known for family values, offers a convincing vision of what America is becoming. We are entering an era where women, not men, will become the top earners in households. We are entering the era in which roles will flip as resoundingly as they have done in this family. You laugh, but that big flip is just around the corner.
Tell me about the Hawkins family.
Well, this is a family of 6 adult siblings who grew up with a breadwinning dad in Detroit, worked for the auto industry, and they've found an adulthood. 3 of the siblings are in traditional marriages, but where the woman is the primary earner. 2 other women are in female breadwinning households, and there's 1 brother who is in a traditional breadwinning marriage. You know, in one generation, there's been a complete flip, a complete transformation.
The thesis you're putting out here, that women are becoming the primary breadwinners, that cuts across race, economic class, geographic location in this country?
Absolutely, yes. It used to be a phenomenon of poverty. It used to be if a woman was a breadwinner, it was likely because her husband couldn't get a job. But it's not anymore. The fastest gains have been among sort of upper economic demographics. So it really does cut across all sectors of society now.
What are the economic reasons behind this?
Well, I think one major positive cause is the fact that women have flocked to colleges and universities in the past 2 or 3 decades. Women achieved parity with men in the 1980s, and then they began outnumbering men on college campuses. And we are starting to see the economic rewards for women of that. And what economists have shown is that 3/4 of the jobs that were lost during the recession between 2007 and 2009 were jobs occupied by men. You know, it was called the man session. And as our economy hollows out and these high-paying sort of working-class jobs are to a certain extent going away, women have moved out of these middle sectors up into higher-paying jobs.
And you think this is a direct result of this most recent recession? This has really changed?
Certainly happening before the recession, but I think it became certainly more apparent and in some senses starker.
I'm speaking with Liza Mundy. Her new book is called The Richer Sex. And clearly we would presume that if women are earning more and becoming the primary breadwinner, that the glass ceiling in the workplace must have dissipated, no?
No, it hasn't. And, you know, women working full time still earn 81% of what men do. That's all women in all fields. And so the danger is that women will be supporting households on less than a man might make. What's interesting, even with this earnings disadvantage, women are out-earning their husbands, you know, a greater percentage every year.
How is this affecting family life? Are there more men who are raising their hand and saying, I want to stay home? And are women okay with that?
Well, In some cases, yes. I think, you know, what we're seeing, certainly what the statistics show, is that men certainly want to spend more time with their children than men did a generation ago. So I think an increasing number of cases, men are willing to be the secondary earner. But I did interview women who were having trouble with this. And I interviewed one woman who said, much to her surprise, she said, you know what, my feelings changed. And I found myself respecting him less as a man. He was a great dad, but I felt differently.
You've talked with a lot of younger women about how this has affected the dating landscape. But I also wonder if you've seen any counter response to this trend. Some reporting I've read has suggested that there is a movement among women in their 20s who recognize that there's been a shift and they're opting to stay home, opting for a more traditional situation. Did you see any of that?
That wasn't the demographic that I was doing interviews among. But what the conflict I think that could create, and I'm sure there are women who are having that reaction, but what the studies also show is that men increasingly want to marry a well-educated, high-earning woman. They don't necessarily want to marry a woman who is going to opt out or stay at home. Psychologists have found, 40 or 50 years ago, when men were ranking traits that they were interested in a marital partner, domestic skills ranked pretty high. Domestic skills has plummeted and financial prospects has risen. So there may be now a mismatch if lots of women, you know, with these great college degrees want to stay home, they may find that the men in their lives are saying, uh-uh.
The men want something different.
Yeah, yeah. You've got all this education. You've got all this earning potential. I'm willing to facilitate your career.
Do you have kids?
I do. I have a 16-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old son.
How do you think their relationships might be different, their generation?
That's a really good question. I try in my book to take a very optimistic view that we'll move into a world where people make decisions, couples make decisions based on affinity. And if the woman is better suited to be the earner and the worker and the man is better suited to be the primary parent for a while, that will be widely accepted and will offer an abundance of choice for both men and women.
Author and journalist Liza Mundy. Her new book is called The Richer Sex. It goes on sale this week. She also has the cover story of Time magazine on newsstands now. Liza, thanks so much for coming in.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You can read an excerpt of The Richer Sex on our website, npr.org. And we'd like to hear from you on this topic. Do you live in a female breadwinner household? Is this good or bad for families? Visit Weekend Edition on Facebook and tell us what you think. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Here's a brief weather roundup from parts of the country this past week. 80 degrees in Chicago, golfing in Minnesota, and ice-breaking mission on Maine's Kennebec River was the shortest in recent memory because the Coast Guard, they couldn't find any ice. On a national average, this has been one of the four warmest Februaries on record, and economists happen to be following these weather reports very closely. Justin Wolfers from the University of Pennsylvania is one of those economists. And Justin, how's your summer going?
One funny thing I can tell you as an Australian, every time I see blue skies, I put on shorts, which has actually been a bad rule of thumb through many an East Coast winter.
Okay, shorts or not, Justin Wolfer says the good weather may be helping consumer confidence. But he also says some economists are floating the idea that the warm weather may be putting a false shine on the recent positive economic data.
People are worried that the statistical procedure used to adjust for seasonality may have been making the data look unusually good. The logic of this is the economy cratered in the fourth quarter of 2008, and what those statistical procedures do is they then think, if the economy cratered in winter 3 years ago, maybe we expect it to crater in winters generally. And so maybe we're overly adjusting for the winter effect. So people were just worried the strength may just turn out to be literally a statistical artifact.
So now, why does the government have to make seasonal adjustments to economic data?
So there are enormous seasonal cycles which aren't just about the weather. We all spend a lot in the run-up to Christmas. Chocolate sales spike around about Easter. And in fact, the seasonal cycle, the ups and downs in economic activity through the year are just enormous. And actually, these are completely separate than what we normally think about, which is the ups and downs between recessions and booms. In reality, the US economy has a small recession and a small boom every year due to seasonality. What we want to do when we want to try and figure out whether the overall economy is in a real recession or real boom is we want to look through those seasonal ups and downs and see if there's anything deeper going on.
Okay, a recent report that was in Business Week pointed to data in February. Normally in February, apparently 485,000 workers don't show up for work because of bad weather. This past February, it was 178,000. That sounds like a huge difference.
Yeah, but actually the thing to realize is even so, the way we compile our employment statistics, those folks are all still counted as employed. They're employed, but they're not at work this week because of bad weather. So what you heard just there is actually just a different way of measuring the weather. One way is to look at the thermometer, and another way is to look at how many construction workers turn up to work. So it's the same fact again, which is just that it's been an unseasonably warm December, January, and February.
So are you saying that it's been even slightly helpful, the warm weather, for the economy?
Absolutely. So maybe economic growth is running a quarter point faster than it otherwise would. I suspect economic growth right now is around about 3%. Maybe without the weather, it'd be running at 2.75%. And it's one of the reasons why I've been watching the early March data so closely. Definitely seeing sun in January and February was a surprise for all of us. Seeing the sun in March is less surprising, and so therefore the boost is less big. But so far, the early numbers from March, and all we're really seeing so far are initial unemployment claims and consumer confidence, but they all still look really good. So it looks like it wasn't just an unseasonably warm winter.
That's Justin Wolfers. He's an economist at the University of Pennsylvania talking about the weather and the economy and how they interact. Justin, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure, Guy.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. For many sports fans in L.A., spring means one thing.
It's time for Dodger baseball.
This spring, though, Dodger fans are enduring a long-running soap opera in the front office featuring divorce, debt, and a team held in the balance. NPR's Ted Robbins has our story.
Things are looking pretty good at the Dodgers spring training complex in Glendale, Arizona. They have Cy Young Award-winning Clayton Kershaw anchoring their pitching staff, and at the plate, the National League MVP runner-up.
The designated hitter, number 27, Matt Kemp.
You know, hopefully we can start out the way we finished last year and just continue to be consistent throughout the whole year.
Everyone has had enough of what's been happening off the field. Bill Shaken covers the Dodgers for the LA Times.
The focus on the Dodgers and in the city of Los Angeles needs to be on the field, on folks like Matt Kemp, on Clayton Kershaw, two of the best players in baseball, not on ownership drama and who's going to bid how much and what revealing court document made the team look bad this week.
It's been 2.5 years since Dodger owners Frank and Jamie McCourt announced their divorce. That started an epic legal battle between the two over control of the team. Frank McCourt won, only to have Major League Baseball take over operations. Then, last June, the Dodgers filed for bankruptcy, owing tens of millions of dollars to former players and others. It was the low point. It was also the turning point. Frank McCourt was forced to put the team up for sale. It's fair to say he's not the most popular guy in L.A., but he is shrewd. Normally, when you sell a team, you find a buyer, and Major League Baseball approves or doesn't approve the sale. But Bill Shaken says McCourt got himself a better arrangement.
He was able to negotiate a setup where Major League Baseball would still get to approve buyers, but then he would get a final list of approved buyers and could negotiate in an auction fashion with those buyers.
Four groups appear to be left in contention. One involving former L.A. Laker basketball star Magic Johnson, another led by a hedge fund billionaire, the third by the owner of the St. Louis Rams football team, and the last group headed by the owner of the Memphis Grizzlies basketball team. The Dodgers are expected to fetch about $1.5 billion. That'd be a record for a North American sports franchise. Frank McCourt has until the end of April to close the deal. The same day he owes his ex-wife Jamie a $131 million divorce settlement.
I think everybody, and honestly probably some McCourt's folks too, are looking forward just to getting it over with.
Folks who stayed for fireworks after the spring training game already seem to have put it behind them. Dodger manager Don Mattingly says this spring he's been surprised by how little he's been asked about the sale.
It really hasn't been much of a distraction this year. It's been way less than I thought it would be. I thought there'd be a lot more questions. There hasn't been a whole lot.
Could be because everyone knows new owners will be on board in the next couple of months. Could be because even in L.A., people can get tired of the drama. Ted Robbins, NPR News.